Thank you, Your Honor. I am Ron Beeks on behalf of the plaintiff. And I'd like to just start off by saying that this trial involved the violation of numerous major principles. I'm just going to mention four of them. One, premises liability is non-delegable. The Springer case, the Vigil case. Two, evidence that's admissible for one purpose does not become inadmissible just because it would be inadmissible if offered for another purpose. Three, directed verdicts should be granted only when no reasonable person could possibly reject the movement's position, and the trial court is not allowed to weigh the evidence, because if there's evidence to be weighed, there's a jury question. And for our trial is supposed to be a search for the truth, and this trial was basically an exercise of obfuscation. And the results of the violation of these various principles are as follows. One, the nightclub vinyl walked away free and clear of their premises liability obligations. And on top of that, they received an award of $27,000 in costs with interest accumulating. While the plaintiff obtained a worthless judgment against uninsured judgment-proof bouncers. Those results are totally inconsistent with any kind of a sound public policy. You can't be allowing establishments to bring people into their onto their premises and simply deny responsibility for what their uninsured bouncers do. I think all of that is also contrary to the intent, the spirit, and the letter of the premises liability statute as well. Now, let's talk about, I can't talk about all the issues, and I guess I could apologize for the length of the brief. I've never come close to that before. I think the longest one I've ever written is about 15 pages. But there are things that I could have raised that I didn't raise. I mean, this trial was just full of errors beyond belief. But anyway, I can't discuss all the errors that I've raised here today. But in regard to the premises liability directed verdict, the trial court gave two rationales for that. One was that the nightclub is not responsible for the actions of their so-called independent contractor bouncers, which is obviously not correct because you can't delegate premises liability. That was plain error. Second alternative rationale was that we hadn't proven what dangers vinyl knew or should have known of that they're exposing their invitees to. Well, that's a catch-22 because the trial court had prohibited me from introducing any evidence as to what they knew or should have known. What did they know or what should they have known? The records, the background, the actions of these two bouncers in question, that one bouncer defaulted and he's not even named in this appeal. But I've detailed in my brief, you know, everything that these bouncers had done, domestic violence, criminal charges, convictions, and were these factors that should have been known or were known to the survival, of course. First of all, defendant Honor had stated in his interrogatory responses that he had told Vinyl before they hired him of his criminal record. Even if he hadn't told them, anything that he knew was imputable to Vinyl, because you can't delegate your duties, you can't delegate your responsibilities. So, obviously he knew his own record, he obviously knew his defendant Couch record, he knew all of their stuff was intertwined, the domestic violence between the two of them, and I've detailed all that in my opening brief. So, obviously, there's plenty of ammunition here, but we weren't allowed to use it. And so basically, the trial court is just saying, I preclude you from first, from producing, or from introducing the evidence to show the elements of your claim, and now I'm going to direct a verdict because you didn't introduce it. That's crazy.
Back up for a second. What kinds of opportunities were you given through discovery to ascertain the control and the ownership of the bouncers in this case? Because you raised this independent contractor argument, and you say there was plain error. You acknowledge that there was plain error. It comes up in the third amended complaint where you want a new defendant in the case that was denied on discretionary grounds. What discovery opportunities did you have prior to all that to determine who controlled the bouncers in this case, who was responsible for them?
Well, I mean, I think that I suppose if we had asked, does somebody else control vinyl besides Bubarina, we could have had an answer to that. But I think they would have denied it. They would have said, nobody does. The way we found out about this was that they produced these manuals 6 or 8 months after we asked for them, and it was after the first trial date, which were RMC manuals, which purported to list all the responsibilities and so on of the various employees. So at that point, I thought, well, we have somebody else that should be added to this case. At that point, I was mostly concerned with the question of punitive damages, exemplary damages. And that's another point that I do want to mention today, is that the exemplary damages, the claim should have been allowed. Beating and kicking somebody are clearly indicative of willful and wanton conduct, and we should have been allowed to have an exemplary damages claim.
You focused just for a second. So I read in the briefs that the RMC Holdings argument, that they responded with an affidavit, and the affidavit said that RMC Holdings had no ownership or control over the bouncers. Did you have any opportunity along the way to conduct discovery on that point?
If I had any reason, I suppose I could. I don't know. I mean, we didn't even find out RMC existed until after the first trial date. So I suppose not. But I think that, even if we had found out about RMC, I think that we would have been told that they don't have any control, even though the manuals indicate they do. But anyway, on the question of exemplary damages, beating and kicking are indicative of willful and wanton conduct. We should have been allowed to, the first time I raised this. As you know, you can't raise exemplary damages in your original complaint under the statute. So, it has to be added later. So not only were we denied an exemplary damages
claim. Well, when did you raise it for the first time?
In the second amended complaint. And that was before the first trial, I believe. I'm sure it was. And it was denied. And tried to raise it again, and not only was it denied again, but we were hit with attorney's fees, which are not supported by the adequate findings or any kind of information that would be a prerequisite to a valid finding that we should be paying attorney fees.
When you made allegation that her claims for assault and battery were sufficient per se to allege willful and wanton behavior, when was that included? Complaint?
Well, the second amendment complaint was the first time I alleged exemplary damages.
Okay.
So I suppose, we were alleging assault and battery and et cetera from the beginning, from the first complaint. There's no surprise. Now, nobody ever claimed that this was not willful and wanton conduct. In fact, the bouncer defendants never even opposed my motion to amend the complaint or add exemplary damages. It's only vital, and their contention, I believe, was that they were not vicariously liable for exemplary damages. That's not correct, as I pointed out in my reply brief. And they also had direct exposure to exemplary damages. And in that regard, let me talk about the insurance question. But Rule 411 says you cannot introduce evidence that a person had or did not have insurance to show that they, that he, as the rule puts it, he, that person or that entity was at fault.
At 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to talk fast here.
Okay.
Anyway, we're not trying to show that Vinyl was had insurance or didn't have insurance. We're not trying to show that LDH or Ida was at fault for not having insurance. We're trying to show that Vinyl was at fault for recklessly hiring Vinyl bouncers that they knew were uninsured, that at least they did not require to be insured, with a specific intent to evade responsibility for the actions of these bouncers if they did anything to the invitees. That's the point. And the rule says that this evidence of insurance or not insurance is admissible for other purposes. The prohibition is confined to showing fault with the same person who did or did not have insurance. Finally, the Denver jail incident should not have been allowed to be introduced because there was no designation of a responsible non-party, and I've cited several cases from this court to you which specifically say if you do not designate a responsible non-party, you can't attribute the cause of the plaintiff's injuries to a third party. And I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm just going to begin by going through a couple of just basic facts. The allegations here involved a young lady who's a patron of a bar who says that for no provocation, no reason whatsoever, she was assaulted by a smaller, another female security professional.
Excuse me, counsel, are you Mr. Bergstrom?
Okay, I apologize. Mr. Bergstrom, Morris Bergstrom, 30288.
Okay. Thank you.
She alleges she was assaulted, taken outside, at which time the police arrived. The police arrested her and took her to the Denver County Jail, the Denver City Jail. Plaintiff raised a plethora of arguments in this particular case. And I want to start because a lot of these arguments pertain to what the appellant raised or discussed, this prohibition against putting in various evidence, the supposed criminal record here. Now, this was briefed ad nauseum prior to trial, during trial, and after trial. And first of all, the exclusion of evidence is discretionary on the court. And the court here properly exercised its discretion to exclude this particular evidence. The supposed criminal record, which is set forth in the brief, involves dated offenses, most of which for nonviolent conduct. The plaintiff raised against one of the security professionals and a defendant, in this case, Malia Callup, a 2001 incident of destruction of property, which was under the rubric of the domestic violence, but it was a destruction of property. Ultimately, that was the disposition of the case. This was later dismissed under deferred prosecution, so there, in fact, was no conviction in the record. The other supposed conviction related to this was an exchange of mutual restraining orders, which are not even a criminal record. It's simply allegations people put forth to get a criminal restraining order, which was, I believe, vacated within 48 hours. This is not a record. So the court properly excluded. Well, and let me continue. The rest of the matters discussed were matters pertaining to a 1990s conviction for theft, a disorderly conduct. These are not conduct directly related to the allegations that were involved in this particular incident, which was an unprovoked assault on somebody unknown to the security professionals. And they were all dated. The most recent incident, I believe, was 6 or 7 years prior to the incident for which this case arose. The court exercised properly exercised its discretion to remove that, which then brings us to the premises liability claims. And plaintiff also alleged a conflicting negligent supervision and negligent hiring claim. Now, the defense in this particular case and in our briefs, we note The club, Vinyl or Bobolina, is a landlord. We don't dispute that. We don't dispute under the landlord for the premises liability statute that there is potential liability for a landlord subject to the criteria of the statute. If she was an invitee, did she know, or did the landlord know, or should have reasonably known that the that there was a dangerous condition within the club? Now, once we exclude this evidence, there was no such evidence properly before the court, such that the directed verdict was properly granted on premises liability claim.
I was talking to your counterpart. I was just trying to figure out who's responsible for the bouncer's conduct. Are you going there with that?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. In fact, I can segue into that right now. I think that's very appropriate here. Now, the plaintiff raised in his brief a new argument that wasn't raised prior to this appeal, that there should essentially be strict liability, a strict liability standard under the bouncer. Well, I think the premises liability statute, as it sets up, is a statutory construct that says, hey, there can be multiple landlords in a particular instance. So the security professionals as independent contractors could have liability as a landlord if they're so deemed, or under a negligent or intentional tort action within that. At the same time, the landlord, which is the club, can have liability if they are found liable under the tort system set up by the premises liability statute. I think plaintiff was trying to cross or confuse a little bit those two different issues, and looking at this negligent training and supervision, perhaps under that type of a tort scheme, plaintiff might argue, okay, this is inherently dangerous, or we should be responsible for the conduct of the security professional. But once we say that the premises liability statute preempts all other liability against a landlord for injuries caused on a premises, we say, yes, the landlord can be liable for security professional's conduct within the premises if the system of the premises liability statute applies. That is, number one, was there something that they knew or should have known that this particular security professional was subject to an unprovoked assault against an unknown patron? And here, the court properly granted that. Again, there was no background directly related to this. That evidence of unrelated criminal conduct in the past, most of which had actually been dismissed, was properly dismissed. Further, the evidence presented to the court was that all the security professionals had the merchant guard license, which is where Denver has stepped in and set up a licensing scheme for people engaged in security professional activities, which involves submission of recommendations and application, and also it involves a CBI background check. Which, basically says that, hey, we've trusted the entity most knowledgeable about reviewing these types of backgrounds and said, hey, we're going to provide service to business owners and say this person or this entity is acceptable to hire as a bouncer. And, Your Honor, I'm not sure if I've completely answered your question, but here we say this negligent hiring, training, and supervision, which potentially gives a vicarious liability without going into any of the independent contractor issues, is preempted by the premises liability statute. Now, if we were to say there is a viable negligent training hiring claim, well, then we get into that and say, hey, there is traditionally, and this has been briefed ad nauseum, no liability for a deliberate intentional tort of a servant. But here again, as I just mentioned, have been discussing, that's been preempted by the premises liability statute, which does set out a system by which an entity, a club, can be liable for a bouncer's conduct. That standard was not met in this particular case, and the club was properly dismissed under a directed verdict. And I would also say, not only do they have merchant guard licenses, this background was not properly done. or was not properly related to any of the claims, but also this particular security entity had a history of working at this particular club for several years without any such incident. Your Honor, I'll just try and briefly, I watched the clock tick down very rapidly, and I'll just try and address a few of the other multiple issues that were raised here, having hit upon the core issues. And going from where the appellants left off, we've discussed the premises liability statute and some of the vicarious liability, and I think just to go on one step further, an independent contractor, and I think there's the Powell case, discusses at length that there is not necessarily vicarious liability for an independent contractor. With regard to some of the questions regarding adding an additional party and a claim for additional damages, the claim and the appellants had ample opportunity to conduct discovery. Depositions were taken, written discovery was conducted on these issues. And the basic facts that emerged were that the security manuals were simply guidelines shared by multiple entities, just as you or I might perhaps go to the internet and say, hey, I have a new business, how do I run a coffee shop? I'm going to download something I find on the internet and stick my name on it. Does not necessarily imply control, which was specifically disputed by every bit of testimony and other evidence that was ascertained by through the discovery process. And plaintiffs had ample opportunity to conduct discovery on that. Plaintiff then tried to add a claim for exemplary damages against the club, separate and distinct from the security professionals and the security professional entity. Now here, when we look at a premises liability claim and the an exemplary damages claim, we look and we see what is the conduct giving rise to the exemplary damages claim. Now when we're looking at what the plaintiff was trying to allege against the club, under a premises liability construct, again, is did they know or should have known of an unreasonable degree of damages? This does not rise to, you know, it wasn't the club beating and kicking or alleged to have beaten and kicked the plaintiff. And I would note that that I think is important for a discussion in this particular case is the plaintiff was also one of the security professionals, Maria Callup, was found to have prevailed on a counterclaim of assault against the plaintiff. So the jury, having heard all the evidence about this incident, said, hey, this plaintiff was not an innocent party. Making these allegations, which was briefed to the trial court at length in multiple motions, they attempted to raise the exemplary damages issue once against the club. It was denied. They moved for reconsideration. It was denied. And the third time, on essentially the exact same grounds and same arguments that it had been using for the third previous two motions, the court then said, no, enough is enough. You can't continue to relitigate an issue that you've had two cracks at the apple at, and you aren't doing a specific new motion with regard to the exemplary damages issue. Exemplary damages should not be allowed here. There was a testimony regarding impairment ratings, or there was an issue raised regarding that. That was a routine denial by the trial court, and it was discretionary, and the trial court made an appropriate discretionary ruling.
Can I back you up for a minute?
Oh, yeah, sure.
On the second amended complaint with the request to add exemplary damages claim.
Correct.
Well, walk me through that.
Well, the plaintiff had alleged that they wanted to, they raised a motion, a very brief, I believe a page and a half, two-page motion, stating they wanted to add a claim for exemplary damages. They proffered a sample amended complaint with a ninth claim, exemplary damages. This particular claim made allegations against the club. It did not seek exemplary damages from any of the independent security professionals that supposedly committed this. The allegations, and I'll read from one of the one of them on this proposed amended complaint, failed to accurately investigate defendant LDH and LDH's employees' backgrounds and propensities for violence. And this is where it stems from. That is what, in their exemplary damages claim, the gross and willful misconduct, failure to investigate a background, which segues and merges perfectly with the premises liability claim and the duties under that statute. They are not trying to say, hey, vicarious liability under an exemplary damages theory for beating and kicking somebody. They were arguing exemplary damages for failing to investigate an entity.
And then in the third amended complaint, they did get into some more detail about the security guard's conduct?
I apologize, Your Honor. The third amended complaint.
When they asked for exemplary damages in that complaint, was it identical?
There was a few slight modifications in how they phrased things, but generally in the amended complaints or the proposed amended complaints, the general allegations were identical. They didn't change anything. I believe there was a few other things, but those were mostly for clarification. I apologize, Your Honor. I could not specify what those are right now. And I see I'm just very shortly running out of time here. And I will just, rather than get into an issue only to have to stop, I will ask if the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Beeks, you have 3 minutes and 40 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, first of all, I'm looking at my second amendment complaint, ninth claim, exemplary damages. First thing I said is the plaintiff incorporated by reference all previous allegations, so that's all the kicking and beating, etc. I stated that they failed to require financial responsibility of LDH. They failed adequately to investigate LDH. Had they investigated, they would have found the criminal and domestic violence records. And I specifically asked for exemplary damages against all defendants at the end of the complaint. So,
isn't failure to investigate traditionally a negligent-based concept, though?
It's just an additional factor.
But you're asking for exemplary damages there.
Well, if you, you can say that wouldn't affect exemplary damages, but nevertheless, when you intentionally or recklessly hire people who are violent, do not require them to have liability insurance, and then you just say, well, we're not responsible for what these people do because they're independent contractors. I mean, and again, they keep talking about these common law defenses, which are totally irrelevant. So again, we ask for exemplary damages against all defendants. Contrary to what I thought I just heard, counsel say that my client said she was attacked by a smaller female bouncer. My client is here today. She's 5 feet tall, weighed 105 pounds. And the other bouncer, it's in the record. There was 5'4" or 5'5", weighed 130.
Did the third amended complaint with respect to exemplary damages say the same thing?
Essentially.
Okay.
We should have been allowed exemplary damages in the first place. We were not allowed to claim exemplary damages against the bouncers, even, let alone the club. And there is vicarious liability, as I demonstrated in my reply brief. As far as the counterclaim is concerned, the jury couldn't believe. When I talked to the jury afterward, the jury couldn't even believe the stuff that they were not told. And I can almost guarantee you that there would have been no counterclaim verdict in the absence, or if the jury had known the truth here in this case. As far as what the club should have done, let me refer you to the Kahn's case and the Raleigh case, which are both cited in the answer brief and in my reply brief, and it states in really the Raleigh case in a footnote that if you're hiring somebody to be a commercial driver, you got a duty to do more than check to see that they have a driver's license. You got to check into their driving record. And the concurring opinion, and I think it was the Collins case, you know, goes into more detail, but there are times when you have to look at the criminal record. They should have done it. Besides that, again, Honor told them that he had a criminal record. He said he told them that, and I wasn't allowed to elicit that, but he said that in his interrogatory responses. And in addition to that, anything that he knew is imputable to Vinyl, and I derived that from the Lombard case, which I cited in my reply brief, I believe it was. So again, I mean, this is an inequitable result. It's a totally unjustifiable result. And is a matter of public policy, if nothing else, in just elementary justice. Everything here needs to be reversed for a new trial. And if the court has any other questions, I would certainly welcome them. But apparently, I'm out of time anyway. So thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
All right.
And the court thanks both counsel for your helpful oral arguments. This matter will stand submitted. And an opinion will issue in due course.